Hello, everybody. Welcome to TYH, a podcast on TRS Radio. My name is Zanglo, and with me I have my co-host, Nike. How you doing?
Doing well.
And then we have a special guest, Keith Woods. How you doing?
Not bad. Good to be here.
We finally have someone, a guest, on the podcast that has actually read some David Foster Wallace, which is makes me very happy.
Never finished Infinite Jest, so it's quite a struggle.
Yeah, I actually finished that.
Well, you see, I was reading Infinite Jest, and I was enjoying it. I got maybe 200 pages in, and then I got to the point where people have drawn up maps online, so you know who the characters are, just like character maps, and yeah. Then you're going back reading, trying to remember the subplots and remember who everyone is, and I got to the point, is this the most productive use of my, I could be learning a lot this time.
No, I read it at a different time in my life when I didn't really have much going on. I just graduated high school. It's fairly young. Whereas now I probably wouldn't have time to read it because again, I have other things. Maybe I could be reading philosophy or just doing something else, an activity.
That's a problem when you're red pilled. You know, you can't enjoy a novel because you're I'm not doing enough to save the white race.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know.
You should sue the copyright holder for false advertising. There's definitely a very limited amount of jest to all of that.
Yeah.
The amount of jest is extremely finite.
Have you read anything from Wallace, Nike?
No, not that I can recall.
No, that was one of our other co-hosts from a few years ago. He read some. He read that one essay. What is it called? It was about media and irony and stuff. It was in a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's his collection of essays.
Yeah, he read that book, and that's a pretty good one. I'd say that's my favorite. If you don't want to get into the hardcore literature stuff, that's a very good collection of essays.
He only has a few talks and interviews and stuff online, but they're really, really insightful in terms of sort of cultural theory and.
Yeah.
Sort of philosophy of what's going on. It's a shame he killed himself so early because he'd be an interesting voice to have around, I think.
Yeah, he killed himself right when things were getting kind of interesting. Was it 2008?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And that was around the economic crisis in the US.
He when you listen to his interviews, he was struggling with a lot of the things you find now that people that get into the dissident right.
Yeah.
Things that sort of draw them in. You talk about the loss of community and sort of, the dead end of liberalism and, the prevalence of postmodern irony and these things is kind of common themes now. He kind of put his finger on it before everyone else.
Another thing that was kind of interesting about him is that I think his parents were atheists. They were academics, but I don't know if he officially became religious, but he did experiment with various things. On Wikipedia, it says, he twice attempted to join the Roman Catholic Church.
Really?
I think later in his life, he attended a Mennonite church, which is rather interesting.
That was interesting. Yeah, there's a very underrated movie about him. It has, I think Jason Segel is his name. Plays him.
And
Jesse Eisenberg. The last tour or something, or the final tour.
Yeah,
something
that's
like
what
that
it's
is
called.
Name, yeah, that's really, that's actually a really underrated movie, I think.
I've only watched clips from it, and it was pretty good, I gotta admit. I think I like how he just, because he lives in America, and he's very American, and so, he has a good context to criticize America and Americanism, because he's living in it, and he knows, the downsides of it, because I think he was addicted to television,
He couldn't have a TV in his house, or he'd get addicted.
Yeah.
I remember seeing an interview with him where he said that the end point of where reality TV was going was that eventually we'd have a TV show where it was about the autopsies of celebrity. We'd have a celebrity autopsy TV show. I swear to God, it's a real show. I've seen it on TV here. There was one about Robin Williams' autopsy, and, to get all his family and friends to. We found
morbid, man.
We found that he had. Lewy body dementia or whatever. So, maybe this was part of the reason he killed himself. He would have been deteriorating. And it's his friends saying, and they turn it into, it becomes kind of a narrative then. They create a narrative out of it, the struggle he must have went through and blah, blah, blah. And it's a weird show.
It sounds like it has a sickening a self-aggrandizement of, like, I knew this dead person.
Yeah, and also, like, after the fact, trying to create some, like, heroic narrative for them that probably wasn't there, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even that is, like, self-serving, because it's like, oh, you're saying nice things about this dead guy that you definitely knew and were really, you know, close with, and it's all about, you know, them, but also you with them, and how there's, you know, how you understood what they were really going through.
Yeah. What's that show, Nikkei, that police show that you were talking about?
God, we have this television show here called Live PD. And it's literally the fucking Running Man, that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, like, just without convicts.
I don't know what that is. But...
The Live PD features, it's like Cops, if you're familiar with that one, but it's live, they have like a freaking like Sports Center type round table of commentators who they cut to between,
arrests.
Yes, between the action.
So they have, like,
it's got cameras like all throughout the country in different cities in America.
Like live streaming crime, and we're like commentating on it.
Yeah,
that sounds like Infinite Jest, like right there.
And there,
I like the idea, like the cops, like on the body cams, they beat the shit out of a black, and then it goes to judges' scorecards. hold up, nines. Yes, excellent beating.
It's yeah. Usually just like, oh, we're chasing this, you know, chubby Latino woman who's got drugs on her, and, you know, we're gonna arrest her because she's got like marijuana and she's like being a public nuisance. And then we're cutting to this, you know, domestic violence case where in this trailer park, now we're going over to this black guy who's getting like a life coached lesson because he's, you know, doing the same shit again, and he gonna wind up in jail if he don't get his shit straight. And now the cool cop gonna give him a talking to, tell him how he need to get it together, nigga, if you wanna survive, bro, and then let him off.
Well, you know, one of the most popular TV shows that's come out in the UK in the last few years, and now they have an Irish version. It was a show called Gogglebox. I don't know if that's reached your side of the pond yet, but it's the whole show is basically you watch people watching television.
So it's, no.
Yeah, it shows clips, like, it'll, you know, the TV highlights from the week, whatever the big news story was, or a big TV debut or a movie that was on, and then it'll show these different families, and of course it's like, you know, there's a gay couple. And there's like two single women living alone, and there's there's all these different families and multiracial families and whatnot, and the whole show it's an hour long show where you watch their reactions to the TV, and that's been like one of the most that like exploded in popularity. That was like the most popular show on English TV, and now there's other versions being commissioned. Just wait, I guarantee there'll be a U.S. version of that in the next
year. Yeah, there's got to be. I mean, that would be very big over here. Well, this is a crazy thing.
It's like worse than the whole concept of the live streaming. I get it. Like, I don't have time commitment to, like, you know, play video games like I did when I was a kid. So I like to watch, you know, I'll watch like 10-minute videos of people's highlight reel from their gameplay because it's novel.
Man.
It's new content. But, like, I don't watch people watch TV. If I wanted to watch TV, I'd just do that.
Yeah, well, it says there are 14 series or seasons and 181 episodes. So,
oh, my God.
Since 2013.
Yeah, I mean, it's really popular. I mean, like, they started doing celebrity versions, and they're having, like, the guy from Coldplay and the guy from Oasis on it.
Or are they going to have Morrissey?
I don't think Morrissey would do it.
Yeah, no.
I'm not watching it if Morrissey did it.
He doesn't spend any time watching TV. It's just like him cooking in his house.
They had a Brexit special.
In which, yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I don't watch it, but it's like with every passing season, it gets more shit-libby. To where it's like now they just like the whole point of it is like just to show like Nigel Farage or Boris Johnson said a bad thing And then it'll be like them like, all.
Here's
all
how the families, you're supposed to respond.
Yeah, exactly.
It's literally like here's how you're supposed to respond after you see it, and it'll give you an example.
Yeah, it is exactly like that. Yeah, because they're all shit libs, like so.
Oh wow, and, man! I wish David Foster Wallace was around to see that.
yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's like, I don't know, new versions of hyper reality or something.
I mean,
because you're sitting there watching people watching TV.
It's so self-referential and just weird and not fun, but I could imagine it being I can imagine like women being very into it, because they really like reality TV shows and they love TV, and so I think they would love watching people watch TV.
it's weird the course TV is going as well, because like I don't know, no one like Zoomers and Millennials now don't really watch TV.
Yeah, I don't. Like, I stopped watching TV. I was like 5 or something because I had the internet, you know.
Yeah,
exactly. You get the internet, and that's kind of it. Like, so the TV exists for people that don't have the internet. So it's like
for like boomers.
Yeah, it is. It's boomer television. Like, because and all the narratives of everything. If you haven't watched it in so long, and then you go back watching TV, you're like, Christ! I can't believe I used to kind of think in this way. Like,
yeah, and it's very boomer, but it's ultra boomer when you watch Fox News, because like the commercials that they have for Fox News are all like, are you 65 and older? Take this pill and your life will be better. Are you a baby boomer? Invest in this and your life will, you know, and stuff like that.
I can't ever believe if I ever watch something like on a stream in the US, it always shocks me how many pharmaceutical ads.
Oh yeah, no, that's a uniquely American thing. That is weird. And they'll have the end where they'll talk about the side effects, the possible side effects.
Yeah, the million side effects at the end.
You may want to cut your cock off after you take this. And
yeah, I almost like, think like you'd be better off just not advertising this.
Yeah, well, it's because I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons because it's very profit based over here, medicine.
Now you'll get see ads for this application all about just buying dick pills.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they have for the boomers, they have like Viagra commercials.
Doctor on the app and get the prescription for Cialis. Erectile dysfunction meds. Yeah.
Do you have erectile dysfunction? And do you support Israel? This pill is for you.
Use your smartphone to get pills.
Yeah.
People like Sebastian Gorka buying an extra bladder.
Gorka, that guy. Isn't he Hungarian?
Yeah, Hungarian. I think his dad was involved in the 1956 uprising as well, which was like basically a Jewish pogrom.
Yeah, that's what's interesting. They fled to the UK from Hungary after the failed anti-Soviet 1956 uprising, which explains his accent, because it's like not like. He was an advisor to Viktor Orban in 1998.
Really?
But so this is interesting. I've noticed that you, Keith, have been into this one guy that seems kind of interesting to me. Jack Ellul. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, French is one crazy language. It's like, there's this one French thinker. What's his name? Lefebvre. I don't know how to spell it. It's like the most insane name.
L-E-F-E-V-R-E.
Yeah,
Henri Lefebvre.
Yeah, is that how you say it?
Yeah. It's actually, I have a French friend, and he's been sending me some videos. It's kind of interesting. They have, like, on their mainstream talk shows, there's this, like, openly, like, alt-right guy, and they'll bring him on. They'll argue with a Muslim migrant that immigration is being done to benefit the elite, and then he writes books on Jews and stuff. It's kind of interesting they have that level of freedom. It also makes me think, like, how can you have voices like this on your national TV and you're not in open revolt against this? Like, how cooked are the French?
How close they got to electing Front National.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're second place now, aren't they?
I'm not sure where they are these days, but
I think they were second in the last election, so I mean they're...
Oh yeah, in the last election against Macron.
Well, yeah, I mean, how popular Macron is now, I mean, you don't know where that's going to go the next election, but I mean, the Front National, they don't seem too sort of based either. They're very focused on the Muslim thing, which is
they prioritized
following the defeat in the last election. They changed their name to like National Rally. They ditched the black and white for more red, white, and blue.
Red, white, and blue. I know it's the French one, but still.
But like the campaign they had and the sort of people who were involved in that election were still, you know, of the right mind.
I think they talked about this on Strike and Mike, that there's been like Bannon trying to influence the Front National and all that stuff, and getting in with Le Pen, the daughter, Marine. But I think that the father, what is his name? Jacques? It's got to be Jacques. He's French.
Jean-Marie.
Oh, Jean. Jean-Marie. I think he's still based, but the daughter is kind of...
Yeah, he was very based. I think what they say in France is that she kind of hijacked some sort of internal coup. She kind of stabbed him in the back.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's moderated. She's moderated the party a lot. I mean, maybe part of it is just her trying to make it more palatable to the electorate. Maybe she does hold her father's beliefs, but it definitely seems to have gone more sort of... centrist, populist route, I guess.
Yeah, this is unfortunate.
But yeah, Jacques Ellul, I mean, I think he's interesting. He was really the first philosopher that did like a comprehensive study of technology's effect on society. I know Ted Kaczynski actually read Ellul, but you know, the standard idea we have of technology in the West, that you know, technology is just a series of objects, basically, that's under our control. But I guess the first sort of constructivist interpretation of technology you got appeared in Spengler, Man and Technics, and Heidegger wrote a bit on it. But Ellul was the first one to do a comprehensive kind of devote his life's work to the study of this. I think it's becoming more and more relevant. Like, Ellul's idea is that what he calls technique, which is not really technology, but more the attitude that technological society creates, is like economic rationalism, you know, turning the eye of efficiency to everything, that this has become like a sort of self-sustaining system, that there's an automatism to technique where it's no longer sort of reliant on human agency. And that gets to the point where it becomes so self-sustaining and self-directing that it starts shaping people's consciousness to the point that it sort of eliminates human agency. I mean, you know, when you look at neoliberalism, that's what you see a lot. Like, Ellul had this idea that once you move into the technological society, there aren't really any qualitative differences between cultures or between nations disappear. So there's still outward differences between a country like India and the United States, but really there's no qualitative difference, because once you're on the path of technique, it's just different degrees of how far down that path different countries are. The only real differences are kind of outward. I mean, from a distant right perspective, one of his ideas that's interesting is the universalism of technique, that by its nature, technique has to enforce universalism. So, you know, for something like air travel, you know, there has to be common sets of standards in every country, and, you know, the rail lines have to be laid the same. And of course, you have, you know, the universal language then of English that has to be imposed on countries. And it's not like this is like an authoritarian, like, elite imposing these things on different nations. It's just the course that these countries go in order to develop. They have to adopt the universalism of technique, and that obviously sort of shapes their culture and their thought then in certain sort of irreversible ways.
I notice it kind of resembles, in a way, like Lyotard, when he talks about performativity, like this idea that we no longer believe in meta-narratives anymore. Everything has kind of been subsumed under the idea that everything must be efficient, you know, there should be an efficient input-output ratio, and everything should be... That's like the only meta-narrative we have anymore, is this idea of efficiency. You know,
that. Yeah, Ellul talks about that as well. He says that, you know, technique doesn't know any difference between right and wrong. There's just a right way.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a right way and there's a wrong way. You know, three is greater than two and four is greater than three. And you can't argue with that.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is this, once this process starts, it's irreversible. You know, once you start discovering things about nuclear energy, it's necessary, and it's sort of determined that you're going to have nuclear weapons. And it also, you know, technique engenders itself. You know, one invention leads to 1,000 other inventions. You know, you invent the car, and then there's 1,000 other things that improve the performance of a car, and mm-hmm. 1,000 other offshoots of that. So technique sort of self engenders itself in this way. And yeah, and human thought, I mean, just by the sheer sort of power of technique and the visible sort of positive effects from it, from this economically rational point of view, it sort of renders other ways of looking at the world sort of null and void.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You can see how that still offers value to people, though, right? I mean, if you have a system like that, then I think it's understandable, like, why people appreciate that.
Appreciate, like, efficiency, because they have autism.
It has something to offer them.
Yeah, but the problem is, it's technique is very totalitarian as a way of seeing the world, in that mm-hmm. people's ability to make sort of qualitative judgments sort of goes out the window. So
yeah,
you know, debates like immigration or, you know, the destruction of tradition or whatever debates you'll see about it in the mainstream, even if people disagree, it's always framed in terms of economics and growth and efficiency.
Statistics, so, and facts. So-called.
Yeah, so even if you want to oppose some element of modernism now, you have to do it in the framework of economic rationalism in order to even have a coherent argument on the table. So any form of dissent kind of just sort of furthers the process.
It's unfortunate, I mean, that there can't be some reconciliation of these worldviews.
Yeah, I mean, probably the biggest obstacle to it, I think, is globalism. Like, I mean, if you had a strong nation state with a strong racial awareness, everything can kind of be subservient to that. Yeah. If you constantly have a collective narrative and you have a collective conception of the good, you can judge things in that way. But when everyone is so sort of atomized and everything becomes very decentralized, it's not really possible to compete with the sort of decentralization that's sort of natural to technique. I mean, an example I saw of the way sort of dissent just kind of reinforces the system. I saw a thing on Twitter in the UK. There was a black guy abusing two Jews on the underground in London. He was reading them passages from a Bible. So I think he was one of these blacks that's like, you know, we was Jews and sheep. Like, did you think they're the real Jews or whatever?
I do too.
And he was...
so,
yeah,
black so Christian identity.
He was giving a hard time to these Jews, and then, you know, some Muslim woman was defending him or whatever. And it's just like every single comment...
But she knows...
Every single comment was like one of the, like, if there were right wingers and there were conservatives, they were like, oh, he must be a Corbyn supporter.
Oh.
Like, oh, Labour are the real anti-Semites. And they all thought that was so clever. And then
oh
all
my
the shit
God.
Libs.
Why don't you just kill me now?
And then all the shit libs, of course, were like completely ignoring what the black guy's doing and just like, oh, fair play to the brave Muslim woman for standing up to him. And oh, you won't see this covered in the mainstream news. And it's funny, like literally right under it was like the BBC London service asking the guy to send them the clip so they could put it on their news broadcast.
Literally, it's about to
night.
Be covered in the mainstream news.
Yeah, and also the London Metropolitan Police have a Twitter, and they were in the comments asking whoever it was to file a report or some shit, and asking anyone with information to come forward. I mean, British police is so ridiculous. You always see them on Twitter. Some shit lib posts some like 6-second clip of a guy shouting at a Jew. And then you have like the London Metropolitan Police there in the tweets like, oh, never fear, we will come to your rescue here. It's like, what kind of fucking use of police time is this?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Honestly, I'd rather the police just be fucking lazy.
Yeah.
Like, you're saying all this, and then I'm thinking about France, and I'm imagining, you know, a Parisian cop just like taking an hour out of his day to like, you know, do cafeing and all
caffeine.
That. Just sitting, having a coffee, having a smoke, and then, you know,
adulting.
Getting back to work. eventually. Yeah. It's like, why can't the cops just fucking do that instead of all this bullshit?
I mean, the London or the British police are insane. Like,
yeah.
I was talking to Morgoth a while back, and he was saying how he had a friend that was a supporter of a football club in the Northeast, and he did some chant or he shouted some racial slur at a football game, and they had it on camera, and they got in a lip reader to read his lips and work out what he'd said.
Oh,
and
my
then
gosh.
Based on that, the police called to his house. And I believed them because I've seen... there's BBC actually did a documentary a while back. I just stumbled on it one night. It was like, you know, BBC Panorama, which is like their short documentary series. And they did one on police and hate crimes and hate speech of football fans. And like, it was the whole show was like, you know, there's a London football fans going on a train to a game in the Northeast, and they're singing a song with racist lyrics, and they get in a lip reader and they work out who it was, and then they identify them, and then they get them banned for life from their football club. And one of them got like an £800 fine because he joined in and singing a song with the word kike in it.
That is utterly dystopian. It's like almost worse than 1984 in some senses. I mean, I don't know. It's
for all the faults, man, this First Amendment stuff's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, the thing is about 1984, it was like apparent that you live in a dystopia, but now it's like hidden under like smiley faces and like human rights or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, they're bringing hate speech laws into Ireland in the next few months. So that's coming our way as well.
Jeez.
I mean, Ireland's been pretty good for free. Like, we're one of the only countries in Europe where it's legal to question the Holocaust, and we never had hate speech laws. I mean, there's an obvious reason we never had hate speech laws. We've always been, 99% Irish. But obviously now with the multiculturalism and everything, politicians are getting uncomfortable with people questioning their policy decisions, so they're just going to make it illegal.
Was there any sort of speech restrictions tried to impose against, like... promoting religious based conflict and
no, there's never been anything there. We've been pretty good for free speech. I mean,
do you have it like a constitutional right to it? So just going off of the good graces that the law hasn't fucked you yet.
Yeah, no, there isn't really. We don't have a constitutional protection like the US, so that's why it's not very difficult now for them to bring this in. This has like cross party support. And of course, the only people opposing it, the people that are launching the protests, are nationalists, which is, you know, crazy because you have, you know, nationalists are the only ones protesting, trying to protect free speech. And then across from there was a protest last week, across from the protest, you have a bunch of anarchists and Antifas that are there, like literally protesting, like saying, please take away our free speech.
Yeah, so-called anarchists saying, take away our free speech. Gosh, yeah, anarchists are utterly insufferable, and they're just they do the work of capital and, you know, neoliberalism and the state.
Yeah. I mean we've got a few Antifa types here, but they're almost all mixed race or sort of second generation immigrant. So like there's one guy that leads a big like anti-racist network where he has a Facebook page where he doxes people and sort of, you know, he posted like a screenshot of my YouTube telling people that action had to be taken to shut me down and all this kind of vaguely threatening language and linking me to terrorism. And he's half Pakistani. And then there's another figure that was leading the charge for the hate speech laws called Hazel Chu. And she's Chinese that was brought up in Ireland. And she was complaining that at the last election, when she was going to people's doors, that a lot of people were asking her where she was from, because, you know, that's subtly hinting that she's not Irish. And it's like, you know, there's clearly no malicious intent in that anyway. If you're talking to an Asian person, I mean, it's reasonable for Irish people that have been around Irish people their whole life to be curious where you're from. But she says she wants hate speech laws because she doesn't want her daughters to go through the same thing she had to go through, which was, you know, feeling different from the Irish people.
Like a minor discomfort.
Yeah. She even said she wanted the law because when she was growing up, she didn't feel Irish. And it's like, well,
because
a law isn't going to change that.
Well, it's interesting.
Your kids are going to still see that they're different. Like,
well, here, I think in a lot of non-Irish countries, like the Irish nationalists are kind of revered for, like, you know, standing up for imperialism. But, like, do you recognize that, like, how can you support Irish nationalism without supporting Irish ethnic nationalism? Like, what is Irish nationalism without ethnic nationalism? You know what I mean?
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, Brits out, blacks in. Like, yeah. what is the point?
Exactly. It's like, what?
I mean, I always say this to, like, Sinn Féin is like the party of the struggle in the north, and then they became hardcore leftists, and now they're complete shitlib, open border types. And they have a lot of, like, legacy support. So people that are, like, sympathetic, like, people that are identify as nationalists sort of automatically go to Sinn Féin because, you know, what could be more nationalist than being the political wing of the IRA? And waging a long conflict against the British Empire. But then, you know, they just adopt all the shitlib stances of Sinn Féin. But, I mean, I always say this to Sinn Féin supporters, like, why does it matter if we're partitioned? Why does it matter if we're 26 counties or 32 counties or if we're united, if it's not an Irish state anyway? I mean, why would I care if Ireland is 26 counties or 32 counties if it's full of blacks and brown people? It's just completely incoherent.
Yeah, no, that's why you can't support, like, you can't trust any, because a lot of anarchists and, like, supposed Marxists will support liberation movements, but they don't support genuine nationalism against the imperialism, because once, say, Palestine gets its liberation from Israel, they'll say, well, now it's time for the homosexual parades. It's time for, like, being an open border society. Even though you spent all this time liberating yourself from Israel, now you got to do this.
Yeah.
I mean, from an anarchist perspective as well, I mean, nowhere has there ever been multiculturalism that wasn't enforced by a state or that wasn't part of a sort of late stage of an empire. There's no natural configuration of people that tends toward multiculturalism. So if they're advocating for multiracialism, that is necessarily authoritarian, because there's no way you can have that without authoritarianism, even if it's, you know, the soft authoritarianism of capitalism.
Yeah, you really do need a strong state to keep that in line. I mean, America has a very, very strong state. I mean, people like to talk about liberty and such. And, you know, we have our First Amendment and all that. But we have, in many ways, a police state to keep this whole thing, you know, in order. A different type of police state, you know, perhaps than it is over in the UK or like Germany. But it is still, you know, a police state. Like,
yeah. And I mean, the other thing from a leftist perspective is everywhere you see multiculturalism, you know, the left gets weaker in terms of, you know, worker solidarity. In terms of trade unions, I mean, you know, the US is the only country in the West that doesn't have some form of universal healthcare. I mean, I kind of wonder if it was 95% white, I think it probably would. Because,
yeah, it probably would. And
I mean, what I hear from a lot of people in the US is they're not really sort of fundamentally opposed to universal healthcare. It's just the aspect of, it's just going to be another thing where our taxes are paying to subsidize black people and Hispanics.
Well, you have even in the labor movement back in the day here in the U.S. was fairly anti-immigrant. Some, you know, you even have some
all,
of like,
all labor unions have been traditionally.
Yeah, everywhere. Like, you have someone even like Cesar Chavez. I don't know if you know who he is. Maybe you heard of him?
No.
He was this Mexican, I think, Mexican-American, like, I think he worked on farms and stuff. He's like a
picker.
A what?
Wasn't he picking grapes?
Yeah, he was like a grape picker. But even though he was like Mexican American, he was against illegal Mexican immigration because that lowered, you know, the wages of you know, his friends and his comrades. And he even used the term wetback to describe these people. He was, you know, and
well, I mean. If you want to talk about leftists being opposed to immigration, I mean, Karl Marx wrote a sort of scathing critique on Irish immigration into England. And, you know, he said, you know, this immigration is being done purely to benefit the capitalists in England, and they're bringing in the Irish for cheap labor, and it's undercutting the English proletariat. And he said the other aspect of it is that it's creating ethnic tensions and ethnic conflict between the English and the Irish. and that's making them focus more on these ethnic divisions rather than on, you know, the elite that's exploiting them. So he was really against the multi-ethnic situation there, even on that small scale of the Irish and English, who have a lot in common. And he was very open about it, that immigration was a tool of capitalists to drive down wages. Angela Nagel is a leftist she kind of has a more nuanced perspective on immigration. She wrote a good essay called The Left Case Against Open Borders. And she goes over the whole history of the trade union movement and just shows how the whole history of leftism has been really closely associated with anti-immigration stances, and how, you know, the first people that ever really proposed this kind of open borders ideas were the Chicago School. And of course, she doesn't mention, but, you know, it was all people, all those libertarian economists were all
Milton
Jewish.
Friedman.
You know, Murray Friedman. You know, the archetypal Jewish economist.
My favorite slip.
Pinochet, so based.
But, I mean, there's a quote from Friedman that people like to share around, that you can't have open borders and socialism. But, I mean, you know, the same, that wasn't their way of arguing against open borders, because the same people were pushing open borders. So, you know, they knew from their Jewish elitist perspective that it benefits them, because you're not going to have worker solidarity in a multicultural society. You're going to have this deracinated shopping mall where people like Murray Friedman can make lots of money off his gold or whatever.
Yeah, and you have people like Jack London, an American author from San Francisco, kind of like a mainstay in Bay Area literature, but just general American literature as well. He wrote wrote a lot of books. But he was a literal socialist. I don't think he was a communist or a Marxist per se, but he was a hardcore socialist. But he was extraordinarily racially aware, you know.
He was like an exterminationist, wasn't he?
Yeah, like even me, I'm like, okay, calm down, buddy. Calm down.
I mean, the left in even the early 20th century, like the Fabian socialists, like George Bernard Shaw, they were big into eugenics. Like George Bernard Shaw's had to play the Superman, which was like, oh, all these like Nietzschean ideas that we'd breed an Übermensch.
Yeah.
And you do find in a lot of leftist types in the early 20th century, yeah, they were big on like genetics and raising IQ and like kind of doing away with what was the working class at that time, and sort of replacing it with society of Übermensch. So, I mean, these concepts aren't really foreign to the left.
Yeah, no, it's unfortunate. Yeah, I think another interesting thing is perhaps, what is the general Irish view on the American, Irish-American, you know, diaspora?
It was funny a few years ago when our economy was in the shits. Like they had a thing called the Gathering, which was like this big drive one year. I can't remember what year it was, to get everyone with Irish heritage to come back and visit their homeland. And people here were calling it the Grabbing, because it was just a way of getting money out of it was just a way of capitalizing on people that have like a romantic view of Ireland or whatever, like just to organize for them to come here and spend lots of money. But I'd say it's quite, it's generally positive, you know, the view people have of Irish Americans. I mean, they can tend to kind of roll their eyes at Americans, because a lot of the tourist types you get are like retired boomers that'll come to your village and buy a pint of Guinness and kind of patronize you and tell you how wonderful it is that you're Irish. So, you know, there's an element to that, but at the same time, Irish America has been really important to the struggles in Ireland. Like, I mean, Irish Americans basically funded the IRA.
Yeah.
Like Eamon de Valera, who was the first president of the Irish Republic, like before it was, when we were still under the British Empire and the IRA kind of elected their own president, it was Eamon de Valera, and he had, his mother was American. So I think he had American citizenship. That's why they didn't execute him. But he went on a big, while the IRA was fighting the British Army in Ireland, De Valera went on a big sort of fundraising exercise in the US. And he actually raised millions of dollars that helped fund the IRA campaign. And then, and again, in the 70s and 80s with the Troubles in Northern Ireland, it was very common for, you know, in the Irish pub for the basket to be passed around for everyone to throw in their contribution for the IRA. I mean, you even see it, there's a movie about Whitey Bulger, Black Mass, with Johnny Depp. Whitey Bulger, the big Irish gangster in the US, and yeah, it actually covers where he was. He organized a huge arms shipment to Ireland. So, I mean, probably the IRA mightn't have been able to carry on their struggles at times had it not been for the capital coming from the US.
I was telling Angela, we're talking about this the other day. Essentially, you know, we had elected to president one of the families, you know, most heavily responsible for helping organize this transfer of money to Ireland and JFK.
I mean, Kennedy as well, wasn't it? Wasn't it Kennedy's dad that was like the main sponsor of the 65 Immigration Act? Am I right on that?
No, might have been his brother.
Yeah, I think his brother.
Robert Kennedy, was it?
Probably, yeah. All the Kennedys kind of blurred.
There's a lot of them.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah,
that's a very.
Yeah, no, I know there was a lot of Irish American support for the sort of open border policies that came in around then. I wonder, was it?
There was always that conflict, you know, with like the sort of I guess you could call native, if you will, like generally Anglo-Saxon or like German or Dutch people have been here for a while, and the Irish. For a bit, you know, and so they viewed him as kind of like recent immigrants, and so they were kind of skeptical of them, and so naturally some of the Irish Americans were also skeptical of the Anglos because they weren't particularly fond of them. There was a kind of
It's funny, even in modern Ireland, like the way they kind of to try and force that sort of slave morality onto the Irish. So the history of Irish struggle is always, you know, it's clearly an ethno-nationalist struggle if you read the people that were involved in it and what they said. It was all about, you know, Ireland for the Irish and having an ethno-state. But now it's interpreted in terms of it was an anti-colonial struggle and it was about oppressors versus oppressed. And
yeah, that's how it's interpreted by the left over here. You know?
Yeah, and that's been imposed on us in the last few years, and you know Sinn Féin probably had a lot to do with it. But yeah, it's because then they can say, you know, your comrades aren't other European ethno nationalists. Your comrades are the Nigerians and the Indians were important. You know, they're your brothers in the struggle.
Or like Nelson Mandela or whatever, and like those. ANC.
Exactly. And yeah, and Sinn Féin was like really close with Nelson Mandela, and they like to celebrate them, and they like to brag about the fact that Gerry Adams was a good friend of Nelson Mandela. But yeah, it is that manipulation of the narrative where, you know, every sort of founding member of the Irish Republic was explicit ethno-nationalist, and you know, the British Empire for them was just an occupying force. It wasn't any abstract thing about colonialism. It was like, you know, we want a free Irish state for Irish people, and British Empire is in the way of that. But now we're meant to believe it was this kind of universal thing that they saw the value of, you know, abstract freedom, and they struck out against the great oppressor, the British Empire, on behalf of all the oppressed of the world. And it's just... it doesn't fit with reality at all.
Yeah,
you know, anything about some of the other groups there in Ireland? Like, there's like very little information that I've been able to find about some of these other parties, like the National Party and Identity Ireland.
Yeah, well, Ireland's kind of interesting because there's never been a strong political left. It's been you two centre-right parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, that have basically been swapping power for the last century, and a very small Labour party. So, you know, we've had Conservatives in power for 100 years, and now we have gay marriage and abortion and hate speech laws and massive ethnic replacement. So, I mean, anyone that thinks that this all falls on the left is sorely mistaken. You know, these neoliberal parties just sell out at the first chance. But in terms of sort of resistance, the National Party now, it only popped up in like 2016-17, and they've kind of been growing slowly sort of under the radar, but they're getting a lot of organic growth, and they're getting a lot of former Sinn Féin members, because, you know, Sinn Féin kind of collapsed at the last local elections and no one could really understand it. And, you know, there was all these typical sort of interpretations of it that they don't have a coherent enough economic policy, or it's because the economy is doing so well that people aren't as drawn to leftism and all this kind of thing. But I mean, the real reason is that Sinn Féin has been drawing its support from nationalists, and they've just gotten sick of them being sold out and all these issues. So now that they see something like the National Party popping up and they see an actual nationalist alternative, they're all jumping ship to that. And I think the more publicity the National Party gets, the more support they're going to take from Sinn Féin. I don't see much of a future for Sinn Féin, really.
Hmm. Do you know about this other group, Identity Ireland?
Not really. I mean, there's a few smaller explicitly identitarian groups like that, but they don't tend to do well except, you know, very sort of small numbers in the cities and stuff. But the whole conception of sort of a broader European identity or a broader white identity, that's not something that's really caught on in Ireland, for the simple reason that it's been 99% Irish for so long up until the last 10-20 years. So in terms of framing things about our place as white people or Europeans, there hasn't really been another to oppose that against so far. So that hasn't really happened. So it's still very much a question of Irishness. So, those nationalist types are going to be much more attracted to something like the National Party that's sort of drawn its lineage from the early founders of the country and is very much carrying that national idea.
Do they have, like, popular events, or are they active visibly at all?
Yeah, the National Party has been getting more active. They led some of the protests for free speech. But the problem is, you know, as you're seeing across Europe, one of the first times the leader of the party sort of went out and got active publicly, he got milkshaked by a bunch of Antifas. And they basically, you know, what you see with nationalist movements, they basically had to leave the streets because there was such harassment from the left. So, yeah. I mean, that's typical.
Do you think that could just be a giving up too easily mentality, or do you feel like that's a more legitimate justification?
Yeah, no, I don't think they should surrender the streets yet, because I think their attitude has been they've really avoided controversy, and they've kind of avoided public appearances, and they've done everything very much under the radar, and if they have organized, they've tried to keep it very secretive. I think they're just being pragmatic in that before they kind of go public and show themselves to be a force, they want to have as much sort of organic growth to be in a place to do that, so that they can't be just shut out by the media. Because, you know, once you have a seat in Parliament and you have, you know, a few thousand members, then, you know, whether the media likes what you're saying or not, they have to give you a hearing. So that's been the approach of the National Party, you know, have steady organic growth, get some electoral success, and then, you know, put the message out there and really become a force. So, you know, they're thinking very, very long term in this.
Is there like a strong sentiment on the EU just with Brexit as?
Yeah. I mean, thing? it's anytime it's polled, it's like 92-93% pro EU, because.
Oh, wow. That's,
I mean, Ireland's.
That's almost universal.
Yeah, it pretty much is. I mean, Ireland has been a big beneficiary in terms of our entire model for economic growth has been basically being the most neoliberal country in Europe, so that we could benefit from big capital American firms. Like,
right, you know, Ireland became a tax haven.
Yeah, so you have the, you know, Google and Facebook and PayPal are all set up with headquarters in Dublin. And, you know, that's been a great source of jobs or whatever. So, you know, we have this really low corporation tax rate, and we undercut the rest of Europe. So having the European market there to export to has been a big benefit for economic growth. And still, people are just thinking in terms of economics. I mean, even the National Party actually doesn't advocate for leaving the EU.
Well, I guess it's not popular, and it wouldn't be a politically smart position to take just given the lack of support for it. So I can understand that.
Yeah, I kind of respect that, because I think if you're anti-EU,
play politics.
Yeah, you do, because the other thing is a National Party is going to draw a lot of support from rural areas, and farmers have benefited a lot from like the grant system of the EU. So it's purely a pragmatic move. And their attitude is much more like if you go in with the attitude of a Hungary or a Poland, they've shown that actually you don't have to take refugees, or you don't have to put up with the EU migration policy. Because, I mean, if you tell the EU to stick it on refugees or migration, I mean, there isn't a lot they can do. Like, you've seen that with Hungary, like, they'll denounce you and call you a populist or whatever, but that's about as far as it goes. And then in terms of EU migration, like, the open border agreement there, that's kind of a bit different. But I think at the minute, it's much better to kind of get people on the issues that they all agree on, because there is massive... the general populace is very much against the current government and the current regime. And there's definitely a space for a nationalist alternative there if they kind of go in softly, softly for the first few years.
So I guess there hasn't really been any infamous cases of, you know, EU scandalized oppression in Ireland. I know for the case of Greece, I mean, there's plenty of examples to go around where the EU and other international orgs that are just basically proxies of the EU are directly involved in, like, you know, Greek politics, and it's a very palpable and visible oppression. And so that generates the opposition, given, like, how obvious it is. I guess that's never been the case, or if so, not really significantly in Ireland.
Well, I mean, the EU really fucked us over, but it's not... I mean, in our economic crash in 2008, one of the big reasons was there was so much speculation on the property market, and the reason for that was, you know, the ECB has a common interest rate for all of Europe, and it's basically set to conform with the needs of Germany. So during the economic boom period, when we should have had a high interest rate to discourage speculation, there was a 0% interest rate because Germany's economy wasn't doing well. So that really fueled the speculation. Mm. And then the Irish government gave a bailout to the banks here, which were borderline insolvent, and guaranteed banking deposits. And because of that, we almost went bankrupt as a country. So we had to get a bailout from the IMF and the ECB. And one of the stipulations that was in this bailout from the ECB, specifically from Europe, was that we had to pay off all the unguaranteed bondholders that had invested in these banks. And, you know, really? These bondholders, yeah, so it was mostly private equity firms, private pension.
Yeah, you're giving, like, all
private
these
pension firms
like a pat on the back for being a dick.
Yeah, it was all, like, they released a list of them before, and it's all these, you know, pension funds based in Switzerland. There's, like, a Rothschild investment fund, all these different huge investment funds. And they invested in these Irish banks that were very big in, like, 2006, 2007. And, you know, they were taking bets on a financial market, and they lost. But the EU forced Ireland to pay that back, to the point that Ireland ended up covering 84% of the EU's banking debts at one stage. So, yeah, I mean, we really got screwed, but it's just one of those things. They have us by the balls, because as much as they screwed us, people also recognize that if we left the EU and we didn't have the European market, we'd lose all the multinationals. So, I mean, this is what happens when you become so reliant on neoliberalism and foreign
capital. That's the buy-in for neolib, yeah.
Yeah, because if PayPal and Google and Facebook and Pfizer and all these companies leave tomorrow, we're going to have nothing left, because all the time we've been bringing these in, we haven't been doing anything to develop Irish industry. You know, we gave away our fisheries, we gave away our natural gas and oil. And to the point that, you know, if they ever decide to leave, we'll be like a third world country. So, yeah, that's the buy-in for neoliberalism. It's like, yeah, the EU screwed us quite a few times, but what are we going to do? We'll go back to the dark ages if we leave the European market.
Interesting. Yeah.
I didn't really catch much of that because I had to do something real quick.
You always miss the good stuff.
Yeah. I got a phone call and I had to rush and take that for like a few minutes.
But yeah, I mean, if there's one sort of lesson from all that about Ireland, it's that, you know, as much as people blame the left for what's going on, I mean, that's a country that's had, as I say, a century of two center-right parties swapping power, and it's a country that's adopted sort of, you know, libertarian, neoliberal policies for economic growth, and it's all those things that have meant that we've had the biggest social transformation of any country in the last two decades, and we're now completely reliant on the EU and reliant on foreign capital, and we've had a complete social revolution. So, I mean, the political left didn't really cause any of that.
It was the right, you know.
Do you foresee a future where just the whole economic integration and neoliberal cultural degeneration brings Ireland to the point where it's like there's no real real opposition anymore with Northern Ireland?
What do you mean in terms of opposition, as in
it's like any hostility? So like there's nobody, like, do you think it could get to the point where the sort of economic bonds and you know, just neoliberal cultural similarity between the two places is such that there's no real differences to fight about anymore, other than, you know, who's getting the tax money?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of is like that, in the sense that the parties in the South always paid lip service to wanting a united Ireland and being very nationalistic. And, you know, the two main parties came out of the original Sinn Féin party, and they came out of the Civil War. But yeah, in the last 20 years, once there's been peace in the North, they've kind of just dropped that. And it's not something that's discussed. Any of the idealism of nationalism is gone. Whenever the North is discussed now, it's in purely economic terms, and it's discussed like, oh, we couldn't afford the North anyway. And all the mainstream parties have kind of given up on that. And I mean, yeah, I could see that level of disintegration in the North. Probably the only thing that's probably stopping that, like, the unionists are a funny bunch. Like, they're so, most unionists are, they'd be sort of newer forms of Protestantism, like Presbyterianism. Like Ian Paisley, who was the leader of the Unionists in the North during the conflict, actually set up his own Presbyterian church, which was like biblical literalism and everything. So they're like a throwback. They're like some of the people you find in some states in the US, like younger creationism, biblical literalism, and because of that they're like hardcore, like anti-gay and all of this. So they're like an interesting kind of enclave that's really against all of this. And you know, if it wasn't for the ongoing conflict and them defining themselves against the Catholics nationalists in the North, they might have abandoned that as well. But because there's such a siege mentality on behalf of the Unionists, it's kind of forced them to maintain a strong religious and ethnic identity.
I see. Would you say that the average North Irishman is more political in that, on that question, than the average Irishman?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, because the nationalists in the North as well, you know, the Catholics, it's the same thing with them. The siege mentality and growing up, defining themselves in terms of a conflict, has made them way, way more nationalist and way more politically aware, and much more sort of holding on to their Catholicism or whatever. But yeah, I mean, the nationalists in the North are, yeah, they're pretty hardcore. And there's still, like, there's a great level of hostility still between Unionists and Catholics there. Like, there's giant peace walls, they call them, like giant 16-foot walls dividing communities between the Catholics and the Protestants. And yeah, it's still a hardcore siege mentality there. I mean, it's never really been settled. It's almost like a long ceasefire. But that's another one as well. Like, for people that push multiculturalism and say how great it is to have all these ethnic groups coming into Ireland, I mean, if the history of Ireland shows anything, I mean, that was the North was a really bloody, vicious conflict. And that's people that, you know, look the same and are very similar genetically, with a, you know, a very, very slight difference. But that was a hardcore ethnic conflict along the lines of Yugoslavia. So, I mean, it's like, if you're singing the praises of multiculturalism and promising harmony between different races, it's like, you know, how do you really explain the North? Because if the North teaches you anything, it's that, you know, all this talk of unity and borders or nationalism, it's completely contingent on demographics. And that's a lesson that we should have learned from the North, you know?
Yeah. I think there's a specific program for multiculturalism that they have in mind, that it doesn't look like this. Because where I see, you know, I've heard some people discuss within the past few months the similarities, or like trying to adopt the Irish resistance model in America as a dissident right political strategy. I thought about it, and there are a few things that were categorically different about what we have in America versus what existed in Ireland. And I think the primary things were there were two distinct sides that were unambiguously divided along a religious line, a nationality line, and even a linguistic line. And having those very key and non-ambiguous distinctions made for a very like clear lines that divide both sides. Whereas in America, we don't quite have that. We have a whole bunch of, you know, white Americans who come from all different ethnic backgrounds and all different religious backgrounds, and that isn't so coherent. And I think that that's a key factor in what allowed a resistance movement to exist in Ireland that wouldn't so much be possible here.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, because, you know, there was a clear, you know, state apparatus, you know, on behalf of the unionists in the north that was sort of supporting their hegemonic control over the nationalists. But yeah, I mean, certainly if it's an ethnic conflict between two groups, I mean, even like in Yugoslavia, you know, the conflict between the Bosnians and the Bosnian Serbs, or the Croats and the Serbs, it almost tends to be more vicious, these ethnic conflicts, when it's...
Oh, yeah.
Even between India and Pakistan, and yeah, when it's a clear sort of binary, one group and another group and a patch of land...
Everybody knows side they're on already, by default.
Yeah, but I mean, in a lot of ways, the multi-ethnic thing is kind of more... insidious, because when it is two sides, you can see very clearly that they're invading, they're taking territory. You can see very clearly their numbers. But when it's this, you know, multi-ethnic spread across the country, it's much more insidious, because it's not going to be like occupying a patch of land and stealing it off you. It's going to be more, you know, over many generations, sort of miscegenating and breeding you out of existence, and then voting in ways that...
There's like a clear, just a whole understanding of the have and have not, right? Because if you do have, like, let's say India and Pakistan, you know, Pakistanis coming into a place that's Indian, is everybody recognizes that as, you know, Pakistanis trying to take away something possessed by Indians, or vice versa. Whereas if you have this, you know, a multicultural state with God knows what mix of people all together, there's not that same coherent idea of, well, they're taking it away from this group. Yeah. But does that group really have it? You know, are they really in possession?
Like, it's kind of funny to think.
Be taken away.
Like, you know, the way the unionists got into Ireland in the first place was the British started bringing them over from Scotland and England and planting them in the north. And there was a lot of resistance to that, and eventually they had to stop it or whatever, but there were this giant portion of unionists there. But, I mean, you know, it would be a more successful strategy for the British to, you know, to gradually import Brits and Scots into Ireland and say, you know, they're just like you, and what are you so paranoid about? And, you know, if eventually the unionists were 55% of the general population, and then they all... just voted to be part of the British Empire. I mean, that's then you've lost, and there's not really a way back from that. That's a much more insidious form of plantation and imperialism than forcibly taking a patch of land and putting people on it. Well, it's just one of them is more immediate, more visible.
Right. I think that's why we've sort of been compelled to understanding the methodologies of demographic struggle, where, okay, we understand that this is the path of least resistance and highest chances of survival. If you just take the long game route of bring them here and just wait for the demographic majority, then, you know, it sort of inspires our response to that as like, okay, you need to have a lot of kids, you need to have a strong family and reestablish communities with like-minded people. Well, it's basically the same thing in the other direction. Universally effective strategy.
Yeah, I mean, the Israelis really understand that as well, because, you know, their approach is to just gradually bulldoze Palestinian villages and put Israeli settlements there. And then, you know, I think the birth rate for Jews living in occupied Palestinian territory like is something like, I think it's like 7 or 8 kids.
They clearly
recognize that the weapon of the future isn't the tank, it's the bulldozer. You bulldoze a village and then you come in and you have a load of kids and then...
Bulldozers and babies.
Yeah, because, I mean, no one... You can't now say that Israel is an illegitimate state because they're like, oh, you know, they live there, you can't just kick them out. But, I mean, ignoring the fact that... Yeah, exactly. That's how they got there in the first place. But, I mean, it's like... I mean, I remember seeing Sargon of Akkad, and he was saying how terrible the alt-right was because what they were advocating would lead to, ethnic displacement or whatever. And, you know, someone asked him if he had a problem with how Israel was established.
Ethnic displacement. And his answer, that's rich.
Yeah, but ethnic cleansing. But his argument for Israel was, I don't criticize Israel because... that's before I was even born. Why would I go criticize that?
Like 20 years before
the classical liberals. It's like, yeah, the classical liberals will oppose you the whole way. But then if you just if you do these aggressive policies and take some land and replace the people there, you know, in 20 or 30 years, they'll say, well, you know, it's too late. We can't use force against an existing state anyway. So. You know, in the end, the classical liberals will support whoever wins.
Yeah. What a contemptible ideology.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it really is.
Is there anything else you guys wanted to talk about?
I don't have anything else in particular.
I got a few things I have to do today, so I guess we should put a bookmark here. Is that what Richard Spencer says? Anyways. So it was nice having you on, Keith.
Yeah, good stuff. I had fun.
Yeah, it was nice, and thank you, Nike, for waking up early and doing a different time. And
no problem.
Yeah, well, my name is Anglo. With me, I have Nike, and I have our good friend Keith. See you guys
next
time.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening. If you want to give us young lads some help, send us some Bitcoin. Our BTC address is in the description. See you next week.